So you're jumping from Facebook to Instagram DMs to LinkedIn to Meetup, just trying to find one investor who's actually building their investment portfolio.
Yep. And meanwhile, you're wasting your time networking with other investors who aren't aligned with your goals. Sound familiar?
Well, that's about to change. We have built Investor Plus, a one-stop platform for investors to make deeper connections and to build wealth.
This is not just about effective networking. We've built a clear success path to take you from where you are now to where you want to go. From mastering the market with our ebook, Market Master, to laying the foundation your business needs to grow with our on-demand course, Real Estate Fundamentals, you will gain the knowledge and the confidence to grow your portfolio.
Investor Plus launches January the 14th, and it will transform the way you connect with others. Start investing in yourself today. Click on the link below to join the waiting list. Ever wonder how entrepreneurs take a small business, turn it into a thriving empire, and then sell it for massive profits? Today, I was joined by Alicia and Jill Smith, a powerhouse entrepreneurial couple who's able to take their chain of cannabis dispensaries, turn it into $12 million of annual revenue, and sell it for a major profit to a publicly traded company. Now they've turned their sights to flipping properties. We cover so much with Alicia and Jill on today's episode. We talk a lot about what their unique marketing strategy was in their local community. We talk a lot about how they're able to step away from their day-to-day operations and live miles away, but while still running the company. And we also talk about how they set themselves up for success from a valuation perspective so they can sell their business for massive profits. You cannot miss today's episode. Welcome to the Investor Podcast. I'm Liz Faircloth.
And I am your co-host, Andressa Gadelli.
Jill and Alicia, you have both had such an incredible journey from managing a band together to building and scaling and then selling a cannabis dispensary chain. And now you've moved into real estate investing. What was that defining moment that made you decide to pivot industries? And how did you ensure you'd have the same success you had with selling your previous company in real estate? So I'll direct that to you, Jill.
Well, so for us, you know, we sold the company in, gosh, May of 2021. And truthfully, as entrepreneurs, I'm sure many can relate to this. You know, it was a huge change. As soon as we sold the company, it was like this piece of our identity just sort of like left our body. I mean, the day we sold the company, you would have thought we would have been like, you know, fireworks being so crazy. But it was actually this moment of like, this like, I don't know, child kind of left. You know what I'm saying? It felt very like not what we thought it would feel like. Anyways, we really enjoyed the time that we had to spend with our family. But after that, we kind of realized, first of all, we had a huge capital gains tax that we had to take care of. So we talked to our accountant. He said, you need to start buying properties. So we started buying properties, truthfully, not really knowing what we were doing, but we were moving fast. And we realized we need to take some time and actually learn what we're doing. So that was the main point. But also, it was just something we already enjoyed. Like Alicia had already been doing a lot of construction on the buildings that we had previously. And it seemed like something that we could do and build together without a huge staff at first. So it was just a natural, it just kind of came along naturally, truthfully. And we just were very excited to start something new because, again, that entrepreneurial thing you can't really pacify. You tend to want to go after something else that you can build.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Alicia?
Yeah, no, I mean, Jill really nailed it. You know, I think we thought when we arrived and sold this company, you know, for a good amount of money that we would just chill, you know, and hang with our family.
Yeah.
But it was actually kind of a somber moment, which was really strange. Like we, yeah. Like Jill said, you know, you'd think we'd go to Miami or, you know, do some grand celebration. But I remember I was mowing the lawn and Jill was weed whacking and we just felt kind of upset because, you know, yeah. We had 85 employees that, yeah. You know, we just adored and loved and they helped us build this thing. And then, you know, it was just closing this chapter in our life. And so, I remember Jill's mom saying to us, like, there's no way you guys can be stay-at-home parents and not do anything. And I was like, hell yeah, I can. You know, I'm just going to be hanging out, you know, doing fun stuff.
I'm going to be at the pool. And,
at the pool, not knowing at that time.
Totally.
You know, I don't think I knew at that time you can't just hang at the pool when you have babies and toddlers, right? It's a very active pool play, you know, it's not laying on a, you know, laying on a chair. But yeah, so we just realized like, hey, this isn't us, you know, we're going to build something else. And we felt like investing in real estate was just such a smart play. And we wanted to really have assets that were appreciating over time that by the time we retired, you know, they would be beneficial for us. But then that kind of got a little bit boring for us, which is what led us into house flipping, because I think we needed a really creative outlet and we wanted to continue to generate cash. We were used to a really fast pace of, you know, getting cash every day at the dispensaries. And so once we realized we were good at remodeling, we were like, well, why don't we sell some of these? And that's just kind of what led us to flipping.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. I think what you're saying is really very powerful, because often people think, especially if they even buy a property and they renovate it and then they sell it, there is like this moment of like completion, a little bit of sadness because it's over, right? And obviously building a business of that scale is different than selling a property. But it is a moment of like, it's not just celebratory. It is like, okay, what just happened? And now how can I replicate this again? So I really want to dive in and dissect how you were able to grow your dispensary business. You generated over $1 million in monthly revenue, right? That's not an easy feat for any business. So I'd love to, before selling it, I'd love to dive into how you were able to do that. What key strategies that you employed to you know, increase the value of the company? Tell us a little bit about that journey. Tell us a little bit about how you're able to grow it to that amount of money every month.
So one thing that we were always very aware of is that we needed to be hyper-focused on our marketing. So whether that was just focusing on the customers in the store or having a reach out to them on a regular basis, whether that was texting, emailing, pretty much all the above, always trying to generate excitement. I think that's super important anytime you're running a business, is generating excitement with your customers around your business. So that was one thing. But something we did internally is, and we continue to always make this part of our business, is to make your employees problem solvers. You need to motivate them to become problem solvers. So one thing that we did is we knew the only way that we would sell the company is if we just like blew the revenue out of the roof. We had to get the revenue as high as possible. But it's because we knew that any company that was willing and able to do an acquisition of this size is going to need something so juicy in front of them. They're going to be like, oh my God, they're making so much money. Even if their margins aren't, you know, incredible, they are going to think they can do better. Every big company is going to think they can do better. So in our head, we were like, we need to just push this revenue as high as we can. So the first thing we did is we implemented a bonus program that was just the employees. So if we hit a certain number every month, they would get a bonus on their paychecks. So that started happening on a regular basis. So the employees were locked in. Then we actually reached out to the managers and said, look, if you can push your sales by 1%, we'll give you a $300 bonus on your check this month. And for managers in this position, that was a nice chunk of change. It was like good, right? So if you think about that, at five stores, if you got managers pushing 1% at $100,000 a month, so right there, you've got an extra $5,000 in revenue, but you're only paying $1,000 for that $5,000. So what we did is we started saying, okay, if you can start doing an extra 2% and 3%, you can get your bonus higher. So what happened was, is these managers instantly were hitting their 1% and 2%. But what we realized is they were implementing strategies on their own teams that carried on. So what happened is all of a sudden in 6 months, each store is doing 2% better the first month, 3% better the second month, 3% better the second month. So by the end of the year,
snowballing.
Exactly. So you had like, you know, a 10 or 20% increase in the store's revenue for an entire year. So when we were doing that on each store, it really started to add up. And I think also that locked people into the culture because they understood as owners that we are willing to share in this with you. We want you to have a good life. We want you to be able to take care of your families. That's always something me and Alicia have been. We like to have people in our business feel, you know, locked in, feel checked in with us as a culture as well as, and also to make money. Everybody needs to make money. And this is also something I think you could do in real estate. For example, with like a project manager, let's say you have a budget of $150,000 for a flip. We say, hey, if you can save us 1%, we'll give you a $500 bonus. So let's say they're saving you $1,500. You're paying them $500 for that savings. The net effect is $1,000 to your bottom line. So you could continue to do this with 2-3%. And again, those saving strategies that they're figuring out will probably snowball and carry on so that you're continuing as, you know, the principal of the owners, you're continuing to get those savings long term because these are practices that now your business is locked into.
Yeah. I love that. There's so many things I want to dive into here with what you just said. So let's talk about the 1%, the journey that you just shared about the 1%, and then you kind of grew that to 2%, 3%. I think that's such a powerful model. One, because you're paying a bonus, you're getting your team involved, like really involved in growing the business with you, right? So that aside, although that's the key and that's why you did it, I want to make a mention that everyone listening, what you did is you did something better. You took what you were doing and just made a little bit of a shift. And what an impact that little shift made. And so often, so many people in business are like, I'm going to do this whole new thing over here. And then it takes them away from increasing the revenue they're trying to increase by trying to do something else. When in reality, what they can do is just what are they already doing and just doing it a little bit better, increasing it by 1%, increasing rent by $50 on their 10 unit. Well, that makes a big difference, right? So it's just, we often think it's like these big numbers and it's not big numbers. It's small numbers, but doing them consistently, you're doing it better, not just new. So I really want everyone to hear that. As entrepreneurs, we want to often do new things because they're quite honestly more exciting, but we just need to do what we're doing better. And it sounds like you did that really well. And you got your managers involved. I love that.
Another thing that we did that I think was really effective, speaking on just honing in on what you have and what you're good at, because, you know, we had tried so many different strategies too, and we realized like, why don't we really figure out what's actually working in our business? So something that we did was we created this inventory purchasing plan where I would literally sit down and study the data of, okay, you know, if we have 100 vendors, but really 20 products are 80% of the sales, how do we really hone into that? And so what we started doing was figuring out this purchasing pattern for every store. And I would figure out that I needed 1.5 times what we typically sell of that product type per month so that we never ran out of that, you know, and that was a big piece of the puzzle. I think that a lot of dispensaries would just kind of order what they always ordered. If it ran out, they would order. They didn't really have this structure. And it's not as easy as inventory management for other products, because in cannabis, the strains and the types of cartridges and dabs are always changing. So you can't just say, I know that I'm always going to sell 20 Strawberry Fields carts. You can't know that because that strain might not be available. So you really had to hone into like, okay, this particular brand and this indica, you know, this terpene profile seems to sell really well. So why don't we make sure that we never run out of this? And so that really changed our purchasing as well. So it was a combination of these things. And then, you know, obviously making sure that the staff knew what products they really needed to push. You know, if stuff was sitting too long, there was just a lot of strategy that went into that. And it was really honing on what we had with the staff that we had, how can we maximize this?
Yeah, what a great point. And I think anyone listening can do that in their own business and in their own, you know, their own journey. I love that. I want to circle back on the marketing, because right now I think marketing is always important, right? Obviously, but I think it's something that most people either outsource or they just don't really have the basics down. So I'd love to dive into, and you said hyper focus marketing. Joe, expand on that. What did you do? How did you become, sounds like you became obsessed with the customers you were serving. How did you really get to know them? And then how did that translate into whether it was customer service or increased sales? I'm just curious to connect the dots for everyone listening.
One thing we did is we had a text club that was incredibly successful. You know, we had like a 90% open rate, which was huge compared to like emails, which it also in cannabis, it's very limited what you can market to because of the nature of the substance. So really, truthfully, texting is kind of all we had. We used to do Facebook ads and then we got kicked off. But I guess the text club was really powerful because people would come in and we would also make it so that, you know, you had to click a link in the text, which would then go to our website, which would then boost our SEO. And so that was one thing, but also we would give incredible rewards. For example, if you got 300 points, you would get, you know, a free t-shirt or something. So then, and this is the best part, all of our customers are getting like these free t-shirts because they're like so excited and they don't cost as much. But then they're wearing them everywhere. So every time you're going out in the city, I mean, these are like, you know, we had three locations in one place. We had another location in a smaller suburb, and then we had one in Portland. So everywhere you go, people are wearing these shirts because they're so excited about this free stuff. And it looked good. But the whole thing was, is like, it's this free marketing that you get. So people are super excited and it pisses off your competition. So then they get ultra focused on you and they start, you know, kind of like not doing as well. So for us, like rewarding the customer with their loyalty to us really made a huge difference.
And then they're invested in the brand. That was the other thing. Like if they're going to go home and wear this t-shirt or this sweatshirt that they took pride in, it's like they feel invested almost like we're their team, you know? So they're going to come to our store now. And it was just crazy the amount of people that would say, I can't believe how many people are rocking your gear, you know, around town. And kudos to Jill for designing really, really cool stuff.
Thank you.
But also it was interesting because people could get these discounts, big discounts off of product, but they would always choose our t-shirts or our sweatshirts instead. It was really interesting.
It is fascinating, right? When you have this like hypothesis, okay, we're going to do this. And then, and then something else happens. You're like, they're not interested in this. We have to test things as entrepreneurs, as investors. So many people listening and so many of the women, even in our investor community are like, is this the right way to do it? Did I get it right? Versus let me test this. I have no idea. I can do the research. I can make sure that this strategy could work. But do you really know definitively in anything? I mean, you could, again, you put your best business plan forward, but you have to test things. So you always want to test quickly and with the least impact on your business, right?
Yes.
So I think we don't do that enough. And I don't think enough investors test things enough. And then, okay, that didn't work. Let's try it differently versus I'm going to test this for the next year. No, that's way too long.
Yeah.
Okay, you'll be out of business.
Yeah.
All right. So I just want to mention that testing is a really important strategy. Test quickly, test swiftly, and then pivot and make changes accordingly and listen to your customers.
You know, Liz, one thing I think that gave us an advantage was, well, first, being a musician, you know, I was one of the first, if not the first openly gay rapper, you know, starting in the 90s, there was no footprint of what to do. I couldn't read a book and, you know, tell me how to be successful in this path in the music industry. So everything that I did had to be from my own thought process. Like, you know, what do I think can make this successful? And then when you go into cannabis, it was the same thing. There wasn't a book we could read on how to run a dispensary. It was so new. And so we had to just figure these things out. And, you know, It was an interesting transition into real estate because we do have all of these classes and masterminds and ways that you can learn from other investors, but we had never had that. So we just always had to be creative from the jump. And truthfully, I think that's why we're doing well with flipping because I don't have a design background. I don't know what's supposed to go with what and what shouldn't work. But for some reason, because I can be completely creative and I don't have some box that I have to fit in, it's just working really well. And so people just need to try. Don't get insecure. When things aren't working, you pivot. They're not failures. They're just ways to, you know, strengthen your business and hone in.
I love that. I want to transition to prepare for a sale of a business to, again, making $1 million per month. is not an easy endeavor. And I'm curious, right? How do you determine, because we hear these terms, and especially the women listening are running other businesses. They're looking to sell maybe their current business and invest in real estate, or their current business is investing. Regardless of that, how did you guys determine the right multiplier for your industry? You know, what were some of the actions you took to kind of maximize that valuation before selling? So the first question is the right multiplier. How did you figure that out and then set your business up to move towards that?
Sure. So basically, just so everyone knows, a multiplier is just like if you are trying to sell your business, a multiplier is the amount of revenue. So if you need to get, if your businesses sell for like 2x revenue, that's your multiplier is 2x. If you want to sell for 10 million, you need to be making what, 5 million a year? Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. So in our industry, we had reached out to a lot of different brokers that were selling cannabis. And it's a highly private industry because it's, you know, so federally illegal. So you didn't really get a lot of information up front. But we reached out to a bunch of brokers, a couple consultants, and it was anywhere from 0.5 revenue to 2x. So that's kind of the range we were working with. So we were just trying to push, get as, you know, get our revenue as high as we could. We were aiming for anything over one at that point, over 1x revenue. And so again, the biggest things that we did were we pushed the revenue through the roof, like I said, by implementing these programs to try to get it as high as we could as we were preparing for sale. The other thing that we did is we spent a ton of time, and Alicia, really, you should talk more about this because this is so your lane, but creating SOPs was a huge, huge deal. Like we wanted to be able to say, and we did say this to the buyers, we were like, we're going to be able to hand you this. This is what we are handing you, and this is how to run the business. Everybody, we have seven layers. We have seven top managers managing different parts of the business. You will be able to manage this starting day one, because that's really the hard part is like when somebody buys a business, there's all these like parts that they have to figure out. There's a bunch of transition. We were trying to lessen that load on the new buyer so that they would feel like this is like a day one. This is solid. You know, we actually ended up moving about 6 months or so, or maybe it was less than that. It was a year.
We moved in March of 2020 and sold in May of 2020.
Yeah, it was a year and a couple months before we moved actually from Oregon to Texas to take care of a sick family member. And we were able to operate the business and we never went back to Oregon. And we did that because we were making sure that our SOPs were so tight and our people were so trained and able, like, you know, empowering them to make decisions. Alicia, I think you should talk more about this because this is so your lane.
Yeah, no, I mean, Jill nailed it. You know, it was strange because we just coincidentally were moving back to Texas, you know, and I think we moved March 13th and then COVID just shut down Texas, you know, within a week, right? And so I think we always thought we would go back, but because we were caring for my mom and we were scared to fly and there were so many unknowns in COVID and we had to navigate, you know, helping our management through COVID from afar and dealing with everything, all the regulations that were happening and wildfires and protests. I mean, it was a wild time. And we were able to do it and we never ended up having to go back and we sold that company without ever stepping foot in those stores again. And that was because of our employees and the SOPs that we created and making our staff feel so capable that they could make decisions and we would support their decisions. And that is why it worked.
Yeah, that's so huge. I really want to just put a needle in that. There's a term often used called key man risk. So when people are trying to sell a business, there's things that are going to be, you know, value add to the, you know, for someone actually on the outside, like, yeah, that's a great business to buy. There's pluses and then there's minuses. And one of the minuses, one of the risks, if you will, when somebody's like looking at businesses to buy is the aspect that someone who's running the business, the founder, the day-to-day operator, is the business. It's an enormous risk when someone on the outside is looking to purchase a business. Why is that? Well, what happens when that person goes away or stops calling the customers? It's an enormous negative. So if you're someone listening to this saying, you know, I'd love to build my business if I wanted to sell it or I wanted to not sell it, you're going to actually build it the same way. Because if you wanted to keep it, both of you wanted to keep that business, you could, because you didn't need to be there every day. And I just want to really make that very key, whether you're building, you know, a cannabis dispensary business or you're building your real estate investing business, key man risk is very important and very much something you need to be aware of. So if you're the thought leader, you're the one that's always out there, how do you mitigate your risk? You know, so it's not you, the one doing all the doing or the leading. I love also what you said is that you trained your managers to really be the thinkers, the leaders, making the decisions, solving the problems. I can't stress that enough. Whether it's, and again, for those listening, may not have a bunch of employees, but you have a contractor, right? You have people that you're leading often. The VA, you know, may not have like 30 employees, and you may. Regardless, you cannot be the thinkers for them either way. And I just want to really make that key clear for everyone listening is that, do I have key man risk in my business right now? And I really want to make, and there's a process to unravel that or to at least start bringing the thinkers and the leaders into your business on some level.
Liz, I want to add to that because that was something that happened originally in our business and Jill had to sit me down. So
it's real for a lot of people, you know?
And I think every business owner that cares, you're all in that business. Yeah. And so you're trying to control every aspect of it, right?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, when we just had one store, you know, Jill and I used to have to do everything, right? Because we started with two employees at first. And so I would bud 10, that's what it's called when you're out on the floor. And I had grown, you know, such strong relationships with so many customers that they were only coming to see me, you know? And so Jill said to me like, babe, if we ever want to scale this, like you can't be in two stores or four stores or five stores at the same time. Like we have to figure out how you can step away and not be the face of the business. And I really thought about it and I'm like, you're right. And I was like, you know what? If I can train people to be 80 or 90% as
correct.
Good as I am on
that's
that the floor,
key. Yes. That's the
then
key.
We can do this. And that's when we started doing that. And we even hired a woman that was in charge of education, which I thought was really unique. I didn't think other dispensaries were doing that. So she would take our staff for an entire week of basically how to talk to customers and how to talk about the product correctly. And I mean, I think that just made the biggest impact. And that and so I would encourage every business owner out there to do that, to think if you are the face of your business in any way, if you are making 100% of the decisions, you need to figure out how you can take what's in your brain and train people and find people that have the personality type or the things that you need to do even 85-80%, you know, as good of a job as you can do and see where your business will go.
Yeah. And I know the women listening are like, yeah, but, you know, no one can replace me. And it's like, we're all replaceable, to be honest. And I hate to say it, right? Because our egos are like, whoa, I don't want to hear that. But it really, in order to build a business, again, whether to you were building a business to sell it or not to sell it, that is a key piece. It is a term. It's a negative on your risk mitigation. And people are like, that's risky, you know? And so I love that. I love the transition when I met you both. You came to InvestorCon.
Yeah.
And we put you on stage. We did some masterminding together just in front of, you know, 500 of your friends.
No big deal.
And you since joined our mentorship program, Strive. And so I'd love to hear how that's been helping you both transition. And I know you were doing some real estate. I know you were involved in projects because our mentorship program is for women doing 5 to 10 deals or more. So they have experience. They're getting going. But I'd love to hear both of your experiences with the program, experiences with how it's been helping you both coming from a really successful, you know, sale to this new venture. So I'd love to hear that perspective, Alicia, and then Jill.
Yeah, you know, we just really wanted to find a community. Like I said before, you know, in cannabis and music, there wasn't like a network of people that you could learn from and bounce ideas off of and share resources. And so, you know, when we, you know, came to the conference and actually met so many women that are doing so much and in so many different lanes, you know, we thought it was really important to join the community so that we could share ideas, learn more and more. You know, Jill and I are always realizing that we will always be students, no matter how good we are in a field, we will always be students. And so we just wanted to learn and connect with other women. And honestly, it has been incredible. So I can't wait to continue, you know, with Strive.
What's the one thing that you've gotten that you don't know if you would have gotten if you weren't in the program? are in our mentorship program?
I'll just say the two things that have been the most important thing to me with Strive is, first of all, it's like proximity and also like the language. So the proximity is just being around people that are doing what you're doing and more. It automatically lifts you up. You automatically are going to be operating at a higher level. It's like scientifically proven. If you are around high performers, you become more of a high performer. And it's the opposite too. If you're not, you probably, your standards will get lower. It's just the truth. That was very important. Also, something is like, I'm not a multi-language speaker, unfortunately, but I feel like when you are trying, I would assume when you are trying to learn a language, the most important thing is immersing yourself. And the language of the people in Strive, everybody is speaking in the language I'm trying to figure out, the things that I am trying to learn. Everybody is doing huge things. And so for me, just being able to have conversations with people that have so much experience already, it's like I'm learning so much faster than if I was doing it on my own. And that's really important. It's just about immersing yourself in the experience that you are trying to find and the business you are trying to create. So for me, Strive has been a way for me to have a daily access to people on that level, you know, and also nationally. It's just not like, you know, there's the investor local meetup group, which is also wonderful, but that's once a month, you know, in the Strive, especially like the Facebook group, there's always things going on. There's always people talking about different ideas and different deals and giving like real details. And you really have to dive in and like understand those things. And for me, it's important to, you know, kind of like give my brain a workout every day by absorbing all that.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's coming from two entrepreneurs who literally built and sold a very successful business. And then to say, okay, now I really want to have that same level of success in buying properties, doing the flipping business, and all the different pieces of the puzzle of real estate. And then to be able to immerse yourselves in the community and have properties going on and you have a portfolio yourselves. I think the key is access and speed. And I think for the women that we're serving and that why we started Strive, right? Really the original passion of creating this mentorship program, it wasn't like we had nothing else to do. It was about the access and the speed so women get the knowledge that they need, the skills that they need, and the support, right, from women playing at the same level. So that's the key, right? Because support without knowledge is just support, like versus yeah. Knowledge without support is just reading a lot of books and listening to a lot yes. of podcasts, but you don't yeah. do anything.
Yeah.
Together, though, the right information with the right skill set, because it's not just about buying the next property, it's about building each other up as leaders and building the team and having the SOPs and all those sort of things as well, not just the strategy. So I love that. I love that you're getting that from the group. And I also want to say with anything that folks join is they have to play in the arena. They have to be active. You know, no one's going to be part of a mentorship program and just be on the sidelines, especially not in Strive. So I'd love to invite those listening who've been on our journey is to, you know, learn more about Strive. We'll put the link below. It's, you know, not just learn, but apply. Come play in the arena with us. I'd love to invite you to. So Jill and Alicia, this has been great. I really appreciate both of your insights of how you built and then what you did to get to the point to sell your business at the level you did and then transition into real estate. Where can everyone listening learn more about you both and follow you along your journey?
You can follow us on Instagram. Our Investor Wives is the name of our handle. You can find us there. And that's probably the best place. But yeah, this has been a wonderful experience. It's really nice again to just talk about being an entrepreneur and especially to it's so nice to encourage women to jump into this. It's really important, I think, I love what you and Andres have done is just building this community for women. I think it's just so important. It's a wonderful legacy. So kudos.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, Jill. Keep up the amazing work. Can't wait to see what's next for you both. So thanks for being on today.
Thanks so much for having us.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to receive updates on our next interviews, go to our website, therealestateinvestor.com. There, you can subscribe to our show, become part of our investor community, and get updates on upcoming episodes.
If you like our show, please share with other women who would benefit. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. And as always, we encourage you to take one action as a result of today's show and put it into motion so you can live both a financially free and balanced life. Thanks for spending time with us.
Ciao.